This is the Michael K. Show podcast. Listen live weekday afternoon starting at 2:55 on 98.7 ESPN in New York, the ESPN app, the TuneIn app, or on your smart speaker.
Hey Alexa, play 98.7 ESPN.
This is Robin Roberts, and the Michael K. Show starts right now. Take it away, Michael, Don, and Peter.
Thank you, Robin, and a good afternoon, everybody. This is indeed the Michael K. Show. We thank you for starting another week with us. It's Monday. It's March 8th. It's 2021. Beautiful day out. A little chilly, but supposed to be in the 60s later on this week. Michael K. here with Don LaGreca, Peter Rosenberg. Now, we're apart, but we're together with all of you for the next 4 hours, the other 20. Well, that is certainly your responsibility. Hope you all had a great weekend. Did you guys?
That's pretty solid.
Yeah, solid. Solid
week. Great.
Little work, little entertainment. Well, I had a Ranger game at 1 on Saturday and then 7:30 on Sunday. So it was kind of difficult to get a lot done because that was like looming. But we made it work.
I listened to your post game on Saturday. It was brilliant as always. You can encapsulate a game beautifully. No one does it like you. You are, in fact, the best.
Well, thank you. That was very nice of you to say.
Yeah, absolutely. The Nets do get Blake Griffin. So that's official. He was bought out by the Pistons. Actually cost himself a lot of money. From what I have heard, he cost himself $14 million over the final 2 years. That's what he gave up to be bought out. And I think he gets a mid-level veterans exemption from the Nets, so probably that's about $5 million. So overall, just to get out of the situation in Detroit, he lost $9 million. That's how badly he wanted to get out of there and go to a contender. He certainly is on a contender right now. I mean, if this was like 6 years ago, wow.
Yeah.
They'd have four superstars. He's no longer the player that everybody remembers. He's not the high-flying guy. He hasn't dunked in 2 years, but now he's actually developed a three-point shot, has a better handle, and they're a little thin off the bench on the front court, so he gives them that and also gives them some insurance if Kevin Durant doesn't come back in a hurry. And the Nets, the excuses are not there other than the lack of defense, but I think they'll be fine with that. They are locked and loaded to run for a championship. They just are. They're that good.
Well, we mentioned it last week, Michael. What's the negative? How does he hurt? If he doesn't work out, then you let him go.
Yep.
When you bring him in here, it adds a little depth, and that's something you may need if KD is going to be in and out of the lineup or maybe he can't come back. I still think you want to try to win this conference. I think you want home court advantage because it feels like as we get deeper into this season and into the playoffs, I think there'll be enough fans in the building to have an effect. I don't think the buildings will be full in the playoffs, Michael, but I could totally see it maybe being 30, 40%, maybe even 50%. So why wouldn't you want to get that extra home game, that possible game 7 in your own building?
Yeah, isn't that crazy that like all year it could not feel like it's going to matter, and then we get there and all of a sudden you get thrown, not only thrown right back into home court, but the most excited, passionate, ready, eager fans that we've ever seen in the NBA because people are going to be so psyched when they finally are able to start filling buildings again.
I think Andrew will be able to answer this better than I could. I know the Flyers were home yesterday and had 2,800 fans. So what is that? That's obviously more than 10%.
Right.
So what would that be, Andrew? Is it 15%?
Probably 15, right?
I think so.
So they jumped right in at 15, and here we are in March. We're still a couple of months away from the playoff. Is it possible that in Brooklyn and in Philadelphia we're playing in front of 50% capacity?
You know, Don, I was feeling very, very optimistic until the CDC report came out today. I thought that we'd see, by the end of this season, a full house at Citi Field or Yankee Stadium or pretty close to it. And the CDC said, even if you're vaccinated, you can hang with other people that are vaccinated indoors, but you cannot be in crowds because you don't know if everybody is vaccinated. So unless they actually ask you for vaccination proof to get into a ballpark or an arena, they're not going to be able. I don't even know if they get to 50%, Don. I thought for sure before I read this thing today. Now, that's not law. Obviously, different municipalities, different states will decide on their own because Texas is going with 100%.
Right.
But the CDC says that they don't know how long the vaccine lasts. They don't know if you can transmit it. They think that you can, and they do not want people crowding together closely until there's herd immunity. And there might not be herd immunity because there's a lot of people that don't want to get the vaccine.
Well, we're going to have to wait and see, right? Right now, Texas is opening it up. No masks, just going all out. So if we fast forward 2 months from now and things are still good, well, then maybe the CDC changes it.
Yeah, maybe.
Now, obviously, if you're pessimistic, we may look back and it becomes a super spreader situation in Texas and we revert back to where we were a couple of months ago, and I'd hate to see that. But the point is that there was a point during the start of the season where we felt it didn't matter if you had home court because you're going to be playing in front of nobody anyway. Well, now you're not going to be playing in front of nobody. Philadelphia's got 2,800 fans. Brooklyn could have as many as 10% based on the New York City ordinance. So we fast forward 2-3 months from now or in a conference final. Because when would the conference final be, Andrew? We're talking 3 months
June.
From now.
Yeah, in June.
So how do we know it's not going to be where you're talking about 10,000 people in the building and it really can have an effect? So Blake Griffin, long story short, can maybe help solidify if KD is going to be out of the lineup for any stretch of time, trying to beat Philadelphia out for the one seed.
Now, every year, I mean, every single year, it doesn't even skip a year. Every year I get hooked in. I expect great things from the NBA All-Star Game. And it's just, it's a bacchanal how bad it is. It's not real basketball. 170 to 150. I mean, it's worse than playground basketball. At least they play defense sometimes on the playground. This is awful. It's awful. I mean, you have Damian Lillard shooting from beyond half court and making it. There's no defense whatsoever. And Steph Curry is just the greatest shooter I think that we'll ever see in our life. But the game was terrible. Terrible. I don't know. Maybe you guys feel differently. I enjoyed the three-point contest. And, Peter, you brought it up. I think it was on Twitter. At least Steph has the onions as a great player who has nothing to prove to actually take part in that. And it was brilliant. He hits the last shot to win it. If he doesn't hit that shot, he doesn't win it. Mike Conley wins it.
Love him. I love him for being that guy. Like, we have just seen for years now people completely scared of participating in the dunk contest, and it's so weak. Steph, like these guys, they dunk all day long in games and then don't want to do it in the contest. Steph has nothing to prove.
Nothing.
He's the greatest in-game shooter we've ever seen. All right? Does not need to prove it and does it just for fun, and you can tell he enjoys it. I wish other people would follow in his footsteps and do the same thing with the dunk contest. It makes it must-see. It was the best part of last night, in my opinion.
I guess, Peter, the thinking might be the dunk contest, you can get hurt. This is just pure shooting. But other great
really?
Shooters should
I
be
mean,
in
can
it
they
as
get
well.
Hurt? Because the second the All-Star game starts, it's a dunk contest.
Right. You're right.
That's the part I don't understand. Like, you're so worried about dunks. You're doing in-game dunks. How many alley-oops did Zion try?
I missed a lot, too.
Missed a lot of them. And Zion is the most fragile player in the league, arguably. And he was going up there trying one alley-oop after another, so I don't see why they can't just try the dunk contest. Because the dunk contest stunk. I'm not necessarily with you in terms of the All-Star game. I'm never one of those people who really complains about the lack of defense. I'd like it to be competitive and close. I don't care about defense. I understand that's not why they're there. To me, the dunk contest was so weak, and it spoke to what we were talking about when Ballard suggested retro names in the three-point shootout. To me, the dunk contest gets hurt often when you don't know who anybody is. I mean, does anybody who doesn't live here care who Obi Toppin is? Can you tell me anything about the kid from the Pacers yesterday?
Well, I mean, the amazing thing about that dunk contest, no disrespect, please don't take this way, to Obi Toppin. They were nobodies. There was one guy who didn't play in the NBA. They took him up the G League. That's the dunk contest?
That's what I'm saying. Like, it really hurts. And then on top of that, it's just really hard, for it to be good. And then out of the gate, first of all, coming up with new ideas, credit to the guys who come up with new ideas, because it feels like everything's been done. The judging is always a disaster. Right out of the gate yesterday, the first dunk was judged way off. Everything gets thrown off, and then you have no names to really root for.
Right.
The dunk contest was trash. I'm sorry.
Now, listen, I know the NBA pre and post and halftime show on TNT is revered, and I love it too. But can they do their homework? I mean, can they do their homework? I mean, Shaq goes, that's Obi Toppin's dad? He was Dunker. It's like they first heard that his father was Dunker's Delight. They had no idea. And I'm going to do an imitation. I don't do imitations very often. Here's my imitation of Kenny Smith during the three-point contest. Oh, he's hot. He's hot. He's hot. He's hot. He's hot. He's hot. Oh, locked in. Hot. Hot. Oh, locked in. He repeats the same thing 100 times. Am I wrong?
I love Kenny Smith. Love him. That is all he says. It's very Joe Rogan UFC-esque.
Is that what Joe does on UFC?
Well, no. Joe just goes, oh! 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 It's working for him. He's doing fine.
And listen, we've struggled with all-star games in all sports, right? And I understand you want to try to change it up a little bit. And the NHL was the first to do the whole drafting of the players.
Mm-hmm.
But when it gets to the game, you want a side to root for. Who do you root for?
That part is hard, too.
You know, that's a great point.
When it's East versus West, it's all right. You're a Knicks fan. You're a Net fan. You root for the East. It's hard to root.
If you're a Utah fan, both of your guys are on separate teams.
Yeah, so they do it because they think this will give a reason to play and make it more competitive, although, you know, it's a 20-point game. I don't know how much more competitive it was, but I think it is what it is. An all-star game is supposed to be kind of just fun, not to be taken too seriously, but if you want a game, you want somebody to root for. I remember when I was growing up, Michael, being a National League fan, being a Met fan, it was a big deal to have the National League beat the American League.
I agree.
If all of a sudden I've got, you know, a Met that's on Team Harper, you know, and I've got a Met that's on Team Trout, well, who am I rooting for? Now I'm just watching the players, but I think we lose touch and while we watch sports, and that's the competitiveness. If I'm watching a game where I'm neutral, I'll find a reason to root for one of the sides. Like, it's hard for me to just sit there and not have a rooting interest. That's just, I mean, maybe I think a lot of NBA fans, and this is the one sport I think where you do have fans that just root for a player. So maybe it works in the NBA. But for me, I need a side to root for when I'm watching a game.
Now, every time I say this, every time there's an NBA All-Star game, the only sport whose All-Star game approximates a real game is baseball. It's the only one. Hockey, their All-Star game, you see 11-10 games, that's not a real hockey game. 170-150, that's not a real basketball game. The Pro Bowl is a joke. The only thing about baseball that's different is that they don't allow the pitchers to go that long. But, you know, Don, think about it. That's baseball the way it is right now.
Right.
So a starter might give you two innings. In the real game, they want them to give you five. So that's the only thing that approximates a real game. It's the only thing. Baseball should sell it that way. See a real game as our all-stars compete.
Right.
Because this isn't real.
But even that sport, Michael, because of the quote-unquote embarrassment of the tie in Milwaukee, which I never thought was embarrassing at all, they went off the rails by actually attaching it to home field advantage for the World Series.
Right, which they've taken away.
So the one sport that actually had the competitiveness and the realness of an actual game, they were the first to try to change it and make it ridiculous because there are certain things that exist just because they happen to exist. I remember having a conversation with somebody at the NHL. I'm like, why don't they just do away with the All-Star game? It's silly. It's stupid. Well, because that's where you make your money from the clients, and that's where you get the people that you're trying to buy, the sponsors, to come spend a weekend in wherever the city is and get to go to the game and meet the players. I mean, it's a business angle. So it is what it is. But you start messing around and changing it, I just think you just accept the fact that this is what you have. And that's it. Don't try to reinvent the wheel. You've tried, and it doesn't seem to really work.
Now, the one thing that we saw yesterday, It does bear pointing out, very rarely do you get a chance to see the greatest ever. And we're seeing that with Steph Curry. There's been nobody ever like him. And I actually think that because of his three-point prowess and what the game has become, and the game has really become a three-point shooting contest. That's what basketball is. They don't move the ball the way they used to. I mean, the good teams still do to get an open three, but they don't cut. They don't look for layups. They don't look for anything inside the three. And I think it ruins the artistry of the game. The 1969 Knicks, the first championship, and even the 73 Knicks, they were beautiful to watch. This isn't beautiful to watch. If you're not hot, you could end up, it's like John Starks in the championship game against the Rockets. You go 3-for-17 and you lose. That's it. That's what this game has become. I think you get rid of the corner three and you move the highest arc all the way back. Near the logo, like if you the All-Star game, put it near the R So the great three-point shooters like Steph and Dame can do it, and then it becomes a regular game again because not everybody could shoot it from out there. Those guys are otherworldly, and if you have them, that's quite a weapon. But I still don't think a lot of coaches would want them shooting that far out all the time because I don't think you'd hit enough of a percentage to make it work. You got to get rid of the corner three. That's too easy a shot for, I mean, for Steph Curry, that's an easy shot. Get rid of the corner three. Anything that shot from the corner is a two-pointer. Move the three-point circle out. And then all of a sudden, you got to return to basketball. Because what we saw yesterday, that's what the league is becoming, not 170, 150, because they do attempt to D up. But when you could actually pull up from the logo, Don, and hit a shot, that's not good for the game.
Well, the three-pointer has become the home run.
Yeah, you're
right. It's become, which we love, but now it's happened so regularly that you kind of yawn at it now. That's all anybody's trying to do, which now takes away from the beauty. If you love basketball, there's a lot of things you love besides the long shot. You love the dunks. You love the defense. You love the beautiful passing. Now it's just become a perimeter game. Everybody's hoisting up threes. And it cosmetically makes it seem like the game is more high scoring than it was. But, of course, when most of your shots are coming from three and are worth more, it's the baseball. It's the launch angle and strikeouts and all the things that happen because everybody's playing for the three-run home run. And now everybody's playing for the three.
And both of them happened, Don. It's a great point by you. They both happened because of analytics. So somebody with a computer and a spreadsheet said in baseball, this is the most efficient way to score runs. Rather than string together four hits, we get three runs on just one swing. So that's why the nuance of baseball, the small ball, hitting against the shift, bunting, stealing bases is gone. The nuance of basketball is now gone. It is a home run hitting contest. And you're going to hit as many threes as you can. And if you don't hit threes, it's like striking out. They'll say, okay, you get them the next time. They get mad when you shoot inside the three-point line. You know, wouldn't you take a shot that gives you another point? So you've eliminated the beauty of basketball, the movement of the ball, teamwork, picks, stuff like that. You've eliminated it for the home run ball. And again, because of analytics. Somebody sat down and said, you know what? Three's worth more than two. So if we take... If we hit 40% of our threes, it's better than hitting 50% of our twos.
I wanted, when you first brought this up, I wanted to argue against you and be like, and call you an old man and tell you to, you know, calm down.
Like you guys always do now.
Right, because that's all we think about. But I got to tell you, I actually agree with you. I'm curious how young people, you know, younger than me, feel about it. Because, like, as someone who grew up loving the three, it really has lost all impact. Like, even from a fan standpoint of it being something exciting. When you're at a game and people used to hit a three, I remember the oohs and ahs of a three getting knocked down. It literally means nothing. It's so, like, I don't... The game isn't as good. You're just seeing an endless amount of threes chucked constantly. It's not as special for the fans to see the three. My question is, who loses if you knock the three-point line back a bit?
It becomes more amazing.
Right. I, that's what I'm saying. Like, let's be honest. The only thing that gets me excited when it comes to shooting now are when people like Steph and Dame Lillard pull up from the range that only they can shoot from.
Right.
That's the only thing that makes you ooh and ah when you see shooting. So why not make it fine? The three can't go back to 35 feet, which is where Steph and Dame shoot from. But you could move it back to 27 and a half feet, 28
feet. I'd move it to 30. I really would. I'd make it a killer shot. And to me, the best part of the game yesterday, like what you just said, Peter, when LeBron from the corner throws the pass out to Steph, standing right at the logo, the NBA All-Star logo, and burying it. And then later on when Dame Lillard took the half-court shot, that's thrilling to me because it's not done all the time. A regular three is ho-hum. And I'm not one of these guys that when people are dunking, oh, let's raise the hoop to 11 feet. No. Basketball is basketball. But this is not what basketball was. And I'm not a get-off-my-lawn guy.
I remember the old days.
I enjoy it. I really do. But I also enjoy great basketball, and you've lost it. You've lost it. You've absolutely lost it. Because everybody, Blake Griffin, we'll go up to what we started with. Blake Griffin now can hit threes. Everybody can hit threes. They know that that's how you make money in the NBA. That's why people try to hit home runs in baseball. That's how you get paid. You get paid to hit threes in the NBA. And if you can't, then you can have a lesser role. You just are. 1-800-919-3776. We have a lot to talk about today. I'm excited about the show. I'm excited about life.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. And Peter, you're such a good friend. Don has left that arena in terms of being a good friend. I wake up today and there's this big box at my door, and Peter had one of his people send me three gorgeous suits. Who does that?
Well,
what kind of friend does that?
Listen, my buddy LV is a great guy. He also understands that you're a visual. You're the face of the New York Yankees. You're going to be on television constantly, and you know, it's the kind of guy I am, Michael. You need suits. I don't want you to look like an ogre out here. I want you to look good.
Shrek is what you're saying.
Yeah, I don't want you to be Shrek.
Now, LV, does that stand for Louis Vincent, or?
You know, I have no idea what his name actually stands for. It's a great question, but I'll tell you what, he's a great guy. So
good guy to know. I'll tell you what, you get suits like that.
Well, I want to know. I need to know how they fit because he only found regulars, and you are long.
I know. I'm afraid to try it on now because I'm not a regular. I'm very irregular. I usually wear long or extra long. I wonder if the
extra long is a thing.
Yeah.
Oh my god.
48XL.
48XL. Wow. You're the real McCoy. You are a real man.
Well, that we know. 1-800-919-3776. We'll take your phone calls. Let's get you involved in the show, obviously, because it's your show as well. It's Kay LaGreca, Rosenberg, and you on Yes and 98.7 ESPN.
Thanks for listening to the Michael K. Show podcast.
Hey, buddy, hey.
Catch the show on demand wherever you want. Just subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the show. The Michael K. Show on 98.7 ESPN is brought to you by GEICO. The real value in car insurance isn't how much you save. It's also the kind of service you get. Good thing GEICO's been perfecting both for over 75 years. Very quick movie review. Now, I gave my review on Coming to America on Friday. Don gave his on Twitter, and I'm sure he's going to want to give his here, too. But Nomadland has gotten a lot of love from the critics and won some Golden Globe Awards. And it was insufferable. It just kept going on. It was this, okay, we know she doesn't have a home. I get it. 20 minutes in, I got it. Now, Frances McDormand is great. The scenes that are shot are gorgeous. But, oh, my goodness. Like, I want to put a screwdriver into my eyeball. I turned to Jody, I didn't know the movie was about to end. It just didn't seem like it would ever end. I said, is this ever going to end? And it finally ended like 2 minutes after I said that. She liked it. I hated it. So that's my review.
Kind of sounds like Tree of Life.
Oh, yeah. Good. Good call. Tree of Life was the worst thing I've ever seen.
I got to tell you.
I wept in the theaters.
I got to tell you. I saw the trailer for Nomadland, and I could instantly tell I am not seeing this movie.
They should have called it No Ending Land.
It just looked like wandering. I could tell it was just straight up wandering.
It was wandering for 2 hours. She moves from town to town in her truck, and that's what she does, and she has no home. She doesn't even want to have a home. She could have a home, doesn't want one. Gets different jobs. I mean, she's great. Frances McDormand's great, whatever she does. But the movie was just, oh, goodness, stop. Stop. I love these movies that are made so that the director could, flex their muscle. Stop. Make something entertaining. Don, Coming to America, you liked. I suspect it's because I didn't like it. That's why you liked it.
You weren't even anybody that I, thought about when I watched it.
No, I mean, you're subconscious.
Three stars, which is not a ringing endorsement.
But it's not a rip either.
No, it is what it is. It was what I fully expected it to be. I mean, sequels for comedies usually don't work out as well as the first. So I kind of went in knowing that it wasn't going to be a classic. But I laughed a few times. I thought the story was pretty solid. I thought the nostalgia was great. I don't want to give too much away because some of it was funny because of just I wasn't expecting that. So I don't want to give too much away. The one thing I disagree from what we were talking about in the soft open with you and Peter's feeling on the person that played his son, Jermaine Fowler, who I'm a fan of. I'm a fan of his comedy. So maybe that's one of the reasons why I differed from Michael, because I thought he was very good in it. I thought he was funny. And
I think if you revisit it, you didn't think he was funny?
Also, Don, it's not that he did a bad job. I don't think they wrote a great role for him.
Right.
It wasn't a funny role.
I'm not blaming him. He acted fine. I just thought it was a little too straight. And when he came out and rapped, I thought it was a little stupid. But Don, there's another layer real quick. that I said I think Michael could have missed out on, too. And I say this with all due respect.
Of course. Now, here comes a rip.
There were a lot of cameos that people who knew all the people got excited for and laughed. And you might not have cared about some of those cameos.
I know the cameos you're speaking of.
No, you know some of them. You don't know all of them.
Okay. Well, don't give it away because people are going to watch it. But
and also, can we just say one thing that I'll be shocked if you don't agree here. If you don't agree here, then you just really didn't enjoy the film. I thought Wesley Snipes was terrific and funny the entire time.
He was funny.
Like, really, like, Wesley Snipes leaned into the role. Like, he took it more seriously, it felt like, than anyone else.
And I think, I thought that the daughters were great. All three of them were cast beautifully, and they were great actresses. But it didn't, I said this on Friday, I love Coming to America, the first one. Loved it. And you could ask Jody. I mean, for the last 2 years, I've been looking forward to this, and it wasn't bad. I'm not saying it was bad. It was just disappointing. I expected.
I think the difference comes down to that you're a fan of Coming to America, the original.
Love it.
It's not an obsession. Like, to me, it's an obsession. Anytime it's on, I'm watching it. I can quote the movie up and down. Like, it is such a part of my comedy viewing.
See, but that would make me think that you would like this less, because this doesn't even come close to it.
No, but I knew going in that it wasn't going to come close. How could it come close? But I judged it on its own. I thought the nostalgia was good. I thought they actually did a pretty good job of having the flashbacks match up with the real time. Like I like the technology, right, Peter, where you see like the young Eddie Murphy with the right now Leslie Jones. Like I thought they did a good job with that. So that was
I like that part too.
It wasn't going to be the classic. It was fun. I laughed a few times. I followed the story pretty well. I thought the story was pretty good. And I enjoyed
Michael,
it.
Michael, you may have helped my... Don, Michael may have subconsciously helped both your and my enjoyment.
Because I undersold it.
You took it down so far...
Right.
...that I was kind of like, oh, this is going to be, like, really bad. And then in the end, it was... Yeah. It was exactly what a long overdue sequel would be. Nostalgic and cute, with a few moments where I cracked up out loud, a few moments where I was like, all right, that was dumb. But in the end, I was happy for 2 hours.
Right, and you knew at PG-13 that it wasn't going to be the first one.
Well, particularly one scene that we all deeply enjoyed in the first one.
And I also thought it was touching and nice and quaint, the whole John Amos going back to McDowell's while... You know, Eddie was mopping. I thought that was a nice scene.
Yeah, it was.
So, I mean, so overall, I
you know, you know what else I liked? So while we're at it, Don, I like how they really turned up the temperature on how much James Earl Jones hated Arsenio Hall.
Yeah.
I thought that was funny. Michael, guess what? I think you're coming around on this movie.
No, again, it leaves me empty compared to the first. I understand what Don's saying, but Don also is a little contradictory. He's a big... he's a big stickler for things making sense in movies. Like, he likes to pick out things that don't make sense. The guys in the barbershop would all be dead 30 years after the
fact.
Well,
that's just... we don't want them to be dead.
I know that.
And everybody in Animal House was, like, approaching 30. I mean, I think in comedies, nobody's trying to win any awards here. You could not possibly bring that movie back without going to the barbershop.
Oh, yeah. You had to.
It's the essence of it.
And did you watch through the credits,
Yes. Oh, of course. I knew so. It's not quite the classic of the soup joke, but it's...
No, but I even laughed that he actually says to whatever the weird shaman kind of character was,
right.
and he touches it and goes, what is this, velvet? I mean, it was like we're... And by the way, the Randy Watson performance, I enjoyed all of it. I thought it was all pretty good. Kitschy.
So you like sexual chocolate?
Oh, I love sexual chocolate.
You always have. Today, 50 years ago tonight, Ollie Frazier.
Yeah. Won.
And there's a tremendous story, if you get an opportunity to read it in the Post by Mike Vaccaro. He 3 pages of the Post does a deep dive into what that was as a cultural event. And you know, a lot of people always ask me, what sporting event would you like to have been able to attend? And I've been so lucky, because I've attended a lot of great sporting events because of the Yankees, and covering the Knicks when I did, I was at a lot of those great games. I would want to be there on this date in 1971. That would be something that would be unbelievable to have been there. The people that were there, the event that it was just amazing, amazing. Well, and I watched the fight. They had it on over the weekend. They actually digitally remastered it for ABC, and it's actually full screen now. It was phenomenal how they did it. It looked great, and it was a great fight. So it was one of those things that had such an immense buildup, and usually an immense buildup is a big letdown. That fight was extraordinary. I mean, they both wanted to kill each other.
Yeah. Well, there's so much a buildup because of the whole back and forth, because you know, I guess white America just became fans of Frazier just because of what he represented compared to what Ali represented.
Oh, of course.
And then
Ali called him an Uncle Tom.
Yeah, and so you had that brewing. And also just how culturally relevant the pop culture aspect of it, like all the famous people that were there. Life magazine hired Frank Sinatra as the photographer for the fight. I mean, people just understood the significance of it. And it's sad too, Peter, and I'm sure it's sad for you as still a boxing fan, of just how it's fallen off. Like, there can never be a boxing event that would be the equivalent of Ali Frazier, where like the whole nation cared.
I know, and it frustrates me too, because every week I am told that the UFC event is the biggest event in UFC history. And the truth is, while there's way more good UFC events right now than there ever was in terms of consistency in boxing, the big, quote-unquote, big UFC nights don't even come close culturally to equaling what a huge Ali, Tyson, Sugar Ray Leonard, Hagler Hearns, doesn't even approximate it. And I do miss that. I do miss the nights the world stopped. I mean, when you think about it, think about this. Boxing has now been relatively dead for several years. Even when they did it, so long after it should have happened, Mayweather-Pacquiao still sort of stopped the world on its axis that weekend. But when boxing was already pretty much dead.
But, I mean, when you read the account, we had Walt Frazier on many years ago, and he was at the event. And he said that cars were parked all the way to 125th Street. Now, the Garden's on 34th. He said that's the kind of scene that it was. Everybody had a limo, and John Condon ran boxing at the Garden. He's a longtime PA voice of the Garden. And he had a handout. There were 19,000 seats at the Garden, which was new then. And everybody wanted to be. He had to keep two tickets in his jacket pocket in case the president showed up. According to Mike Vaccaro's story, had to keep two tickets just in case, because everybody wanted to come to that event. All the Knicks and the Rangers were there. Frank Sinatra, as Don said, was a photographer for Life magazine. I don't think you could ever have an event like that anymore. I don't think you can. And that was the beginning of closed circuit. So there were only 19,000 right. people in the building, but 300 million people watched it around the world.
And, you know, Pacquiao Mayweather might have turned the sports world on its axis, but not the world.
Oh, yeah, yeah, no, different level.
This just
different level.
Had everybody. And listen, that was the way I was growing up, Michael. You knew who the heavyweight champion was. You could rattle off the heavyweight champion the way you can rattle off any champion in the four major sports. And when the heavyweights fought, you watched. Whether you went closed circuit, whether you went to somebody's house with the pay-per-view, you watched the heavyweights go. And
well, boxing,
the alphabet soup ruined it, too, and all that. But when I, you know, growing up...
And boxing couldn't catch a break.
Fight was like watching the Super Bowl.
No. I'm so grateful that I was at least able to be in high school while Mike was in his prime, because those weekends were so fun. But also, boxing can't catch a break, because it started to pick up some steam right before COVID. One of the last big events before COVID was Wilder Fury 2. And then we all thought we'd get set, and we'd get right after that, they'd roll right into Fury, Joshua, Wembley Stadium, the battle for England, all that stuff, and it everything's been knocked off.
And if you go to Deadspin today, our former colleague Wally Matthews, who's the preeminent boxing writer, I think, of our generation, he's that great.
He's one of them. Yeah,
he has an unbelievable story on Ali Frazier and what it meant and the type of fight that it was, and just and I don't know if you guys have you ever seen the broadcast. I don't think they showed.
A lot I learned from the HBO documentary.
All right, so Don Dunphy, the broadcast. Legendary, did the blow-by-blow. You know who was his analyst? Burt Lancaster.
Yeah.
I'd like to get to the bottom. How is Burt Lancaster, an actor, the analyst on a fight like this, and he kept saying things that are cringeworthy now? He kept saying, boy, these boys have really, these are two well-built boys, and you could not say that in 2021. And you wouldn't have an actor. And if there was an actor that was the analyst on a major fight, you go, why is this happening?
But that did happen more often back then in general.
I guess.
Where they pull out sort of weird celebrities.
But why Burt Lancaster?
I can't speak to that.
I think that's more of a role maybe for Charlton Heston. I'm not sure. Who knows?
Let's go to how big boxing was. It was that crossover.
Yeah. It was amazing. Just read Vaccaro's story. It brings you back to that day. So good. And again, that's an event that I would like to go back and go to. Just amazing. Just amazing. Let's go to Kenny in New Jersey. Kenny?
Hey, what's up, fellas? How y'all doing today?
Good. How are you, Ken?
I'm good, man. I was enjoying the show, and I wanted to make a comment about Ali.
Sure.
And Frazier. Back when I'm 50, so when I was smaller, boxing was like the ultimate gladiator sport, you know, the ultimate combat sport. Larry Holmes and Ali and then Tyson. I mean, you couldn't miss those fights. But now we got the MMA, the UFC, and it's kind of like it took a lot of energy out of boxing as being like the ultimate combat sport. So a lot of the younger people, they're looking at Ali more from his history as an activist than his boxing history.
Great point. You know? And you're right, the viciousness of boxing where, I mean, you'd have the greatest athletes, you know, that did that in a boxing ring. Now they go to MMA. And I think what Don said, the alphabet soup has really ruined it. There's just too many champions. You don't, who's the champion? You can have anybody be a champion. If you pay the fee to the governing body, they'll give you a belt. It's sick. It's sick. And this, I've always said, you don't want, like, government involved in everything, but the government should streamline this. There's got to be one governing body. There's one belt for each weight class. That's all there is to it.
I don't think it's ruined. I know this is not a popular opinion. I do not think it's the multiple governing bodies that ruined it, because while they may have individually ruined it, conceptually it doesn't ruin it to me. I think, like, for example, when Mike Tyson beats Trevor Burbick and gets whatever it was, the WBC and the WBA, we were able to keep track of everything that happened. Like, the WBC, the IBF, and the WBA were the titles that mattered, and you were able to keep track of that, and by having a couple of different champions, it could make for interesting title fights where all the titles came together. I think it can work. The problem is just those governing bodies being corrupt.
And also the problem is that if you have a belt, you never see unifying matches anymore. They always want to have a belt because that sells you for your next fight. So you never see one belt united with the other two belts. Very, very rare. And then you throw the IBF in there as well. It just goes on and on. It's too much. It's too much. And that's why in the heavyweight division, you always still hear that term lineal champ. The actual champ that, you know, goes all the way back in time before there were this proliferation of belts. Another interesting stat about Frazier in the Vaccaro story, he fought for 10 years after that. He only had 9 fights, and he lost 4 of them.
Wow.
2 to Ali and 2 to Foreman. That's it. He was never the same. He was in a hospital.
Yeah.
After the fight, and Ali actually went to the emergency room because if you see the end of the fight, Frazier broke his right jaw, I believe. So, I mean, it took a lot out of both of them. And you can see, if you watch the fight, it's the beginning of Ali. You could see the germination of the rope-a-dope where he got George Foreman. But the rope-a-dope didn't work on Joe Frazier because he was such an elitely trained athlete. He just didn't wear down. He was like a truck. George Foreman wore down after 8 rounds of hitting him.
Ali was so unfair to Frazier, though.
Oh.
So unfair.
Frazier hated him to his dying day.
Yeah. Cool, because he painted him out to be a monster, and it was all in the name of promotion, but Frazier had to live with all that.
It sounds like Ali had regrets about it, too.
I don't know.
I feel like I saw that in the last Ali documentary that I saw.
I mean, remember when Ali was at the Atlanta Olympics and he was lighting the torch, and Parkinson had really taken over? He was shaking, and Joe Frazier said publicly, "I want him to fall into the fire."
Oh my Lord! That, you know, you had, and by the way, you had to respect that.
I would never have forgiven him. I mean, he made Joe Frazier's life awful.
Well, that's what I'm saying. That is laminated.
I mean,
listening,
he called him the gorilla in Manila.
Yeah, it wasn't good.
Let's go to Steve in Florida. Steve.
Yeah, hi, gentlemen. Thanks for taking the call. You're talking about the fight, and also a little bit earlier about the demise of boxing and what Andrew likes, different types of sports.
Mm-hmm.
I was in high school in 1971. I couldn't afford to go to a theater, watch the thing. People were listening to reports on the radio. The next day in school, it was tremendous. But growing up in an Italian-American neighborhood in Brooklyn, the three biggest sports in the 1960s, the early 60s and the mid-60s, were in this order: baseball, boxing, and horse racing,
yep.
Believe it or not.
Yep.
I think it's because horse racing, a lot of people will be, you know, in the back of my uncle's drugstore, they all like to talk about betting on the horses and all that stuff. But college football and college and the NFL were like, oh, yeah, that's nice. But it was baseball, and boxing was the biggest thing. I mean, the talk about you know, the thriller in Manila and all that stuff. I mean, they used to do replays on the, I think it was the Wide World of Sports, a week after the fight with the pay-per-view.
And it would get a huge audience.
It would be. I mean, they would know the ending, but a lot of people couldn't afford to see it. So then they would watch it. And I remember my friends and I were all in high school were saying, oh, I think that Ali lost. No, I think he won. You know, that kind of stuff. Anyway, that was just my...
It is strange, Steve. The sports that were big back then, horse racing is not the same, and boxing's not the same. And those are like the sports of kings. And it was just... And when they would have these pay-per-view fights, there was no thievery of the fights where they could show them online. There was no line. There was no online. So, I mean, you were either in the theater watching the closed circuit, you couldn't watch it at home, or you were at the venue... And if not, there was no radio play-by-play. They didn't want that. They wanted you to pay to go to the event. And then, I mean, Ken Norton, Muhammad Ali sold out Yankee Stadium in 1976. Sold it out. Schmeling Lewis sold out the old Yankee Stadium. I mean, fights used to be a big deal. I don't know if you could sell out stadiums anymore.
Well,
no, if Mike Tyson came back to fight Tyson Fury, you'd sell out 100,000 seat event.
Well, but he was the last star.
You know, if you watch Raging Bull, right, which is about Jake LaMotta, who is not a heavyweight, you know, where is he fighting? Tiger Stadium?
Yep.
They were fighting in ballparks. And it didn't even have to be a heavyweight to fill a ballpark. It was a different world.
And if you were at an event like that, Don, you couldn't see. If you were, like, far away, you couldn't see. There was no scoreboard to show it up close. You had to have binoculars or just a good imagination.
Can I ask you a question, though? How often were fights held on Mondays?
Was this a Monday?
Monday, March 8th.
It's weird. I don't know.
Do you
remember
that as a kid?
It started at like 10:15. Here's what I remember about this fight. It's the first bet I ever made. I made a bet with the kid. I guess it was in second grade in 1971. And I bet a kid a quarter that Joe Frazier would win.
That's big money for you.
If I lost, I don't know where I was going to have to get. I'm going to have to take it from my dad. And that could have led to other repercussions.
Right.
And
yeah,
I woke father. Up and I said to my dad, "Who won?" And he said, "Joe Frazier." Oh, good. And I got the quarter. I still have it.
I lost good my first you. Bet. I bet
did
a dollar
really?
With Glenn Vitregowski, my next door neighbor. He was a Yankee fan and I was a Met fan. But, you know, in the 77 World Series, I wanted the Dodgers to win. So I bet a dollar. My father was red hot. He's like, "You better have the dollar to give him. If you lose, I ain't giving it to you."
I love you, Dad.
You don't bet unless you got the money.
Now, I got to ask you a question,
you know, I lost
Don.
That bet.
Better next door neighbor, Glenn or Carlos?
Great question.
Well, obviously, Glenn was my next door neighbor for the first, you know, 20 some odd years of my life. So it'd be Glenn.
I'm not asking for a dissertation. I just, who's the better next door neighbor?
I don't remember Glenn helping me shovel
or make cookies.
But well, that answers Glenn's no longer with us, so I don't want to speak ill of the
Glenn's
dead,
no longer with us?
No, unfortunately, no.
What happened?
He died of a heart attack a couple of years ago.
Oh, that's awful. Huh. Bringing down the show. And
well,
Glenn.
You asked.
I know, but gee.
It's kind of our fault there. We
sometimes you ask too many questions, you know?
I know. It's we can't help it. We're both breathtakingly great broadcasters.
And listeners. The Michael Kay Show on 98.7 ESPN is brought to you by GEICO. The real value in car insurance isn't how much you save. Nope. Also, the kind of service you get. Good thing GEICO's been perfecting both for over 75 years. It's Kay LaGreca-Rosenberg and you on Yes at 98.7 ESPN.
Thanks for listening to the Michael Kay Show podcast.
Well, that's awesome.
Looking for more access to the show?
That's right, man.
Check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at TMKS ESPN.
Picture this. You arrive at your hotel. You have an important online meeting lined up with clients from all across the country. You have your laptop open, ready to begin, and the Wi-Fi is so terrible, you can't even connect. These types of stressful situations happen all the time, but they don't have to. When you book a room at La Quinta by Wyndham, you have access to their free high-speed Wi-Fi, so you can take care of those critical emails, join your meetings on time, and even unwind by streaming your favorite shows without having to worry. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book direct at LQ.com.
Oh, what a red-hot first 2 hours of the show. Nobody can complain. No one. No one has the right.
No.
Talking
won't
about
stop
the Creighton,
them, though.
Of course. That's why Twitter exists. Talking about Creighton head coach Greg McDermott being reinstated after one-game suspension after using the term of a plantation when talking to his club following a loss. Here is Marcus Zigorowski, who's one of the star players on the Creighton team, talking about Coach McDermott.
Obviously, it's a real sensitive topic. You know, a lot of guys in that locker room, you know, were hurting from it. And, you know, I was hurting from, you know, what he said. But at the same time, you know, Coach Mack he's been a huge mentor for me. And I know he would take a bullet for me and everybody in that locker room, including the coaching staff. So, you know, I just want to, you know, make that point across to whoever's watching. And obviously, you know, the whole situation is real tough. It's a sensitive topic, but I just wanted to say that you know, I know we made a really sensitive mistake, really bad mistake with what he said, but only I know everything that he's done for me as a player, but more important as a human being. And he loves me, he loves everybody in that locker room, and you know, he's shown that every single day I've been on this campus since June of 2018. So you know, that's my coach, and I love that dude, and you know, but people make mistakes, and that's my guy.
There you go. There you go. Now, he's not one of the five players that was actually on the video saying how upset they were by the words. He was not on that original video, but there he is being quoted. And he is the brother of Michael Carter Williams. So, listen, I'm not a big cancel culture fan. And if the guy has no previous history of any hateful language or bad intent, then I don't think that you ruin the person's life. But I also, as I said earlier, one game seems so slap on the wrist-ish. If he didn't deserve to be suspended for a lengthy time, then don't suspend him. It's almost like, you know, the David Cone term, eyewash. You know, well, we gave him something for those that think he did something terrible. Well, for those that think he did something terrible, one game's not going to be enough. And for those that don't think he did anything wrong, one game's too much. So you split the baby and you upset everybody.
Well, but you're
and
not...
there's such a bad sign to it. He's coming back for the Big East tournament, though. So if there were three games left in the regular season, he probably should be suspended for three games. It's like when in college football, when they suspend somebody that did something wrong, they only suspend them for the first series or the first half, and then they'll come back. If it's a big game, if it's a lousy game, again, you know, a homecoming sort of game, then they suspend them for the whole game.
Listen, there's a lot of PR that goes into this, Michael, and I'm sure Creighton wanted to give him something so they can say, hey, listen, we didn't ignore it. We acknowledge something bad happened here, and we believe it's worth one game. If they don't do anything, then there's going to be people who feel like, all right, maybe he's not a racist, but you can't say he didn't do anything. I mean, even the player that was coming to his defense said it was insensitive what he said. So we can debate whether it's worth their game or not, but I think it would have been a lot worse for Creighton if they didn't do anything. So I don't
hear
think
what you're saying, but one game is not really doing anything.
But it's something. They acknowledge that something went wrong, and they believe that it's worth a game.
This portion of the Michael Kay Show on 98.7 ESPN brought to you by 2x London. Join 2x London, the engagement shop at London Jewelers, for their annual wedding band event from Thursday, March 18th through Sunday, March 21st. So you enjoy 20% off all wedding bands for locations. And to make an appointment, visit 2xlondon.com. Big story, Blake Griffin officially a Net. And this is the statement from Nets general manager Sean Marks. We're fortunate to be able to add a player of Blake's caliber to our roster at this point in the season. Blake is a versatile front court player with a long track record of success in our league, and we're excited about the impact he'll make for us both on and off the court in Brooklyn. So a couple of things to know about Blake Griffin. If you're expecting Blake Griffin from Lob City, that's not him. That's not him. He's had extensive surgery on his left knee. He doesn't have the hops that he once had. In fact, he hasn't dunked in 2 years. He didn't dunk this year at all with the Pistons. But he's not that far removed from being an outstanding player, averaging about 25 points a game. But that knee injury certainly has lessened his jumping ability and changed the player that he is. He can now hit the three. He can handle a little bit better. But in terms of being underneath and dunking the ball, you're not going to see that show. But the Nets don't need that show. That's why it's a perfect situation for Blake Griffin. That's why he sacrificed, I believe I read, $14 million to get out of his Detroit Piston contract. He gave $14 million back. Players don't give money back. And I think that the deal with the Nets, as best I can find out, is about for $5 million a veterans minimum. So, you know, in all, he sacrificed $9 million to come here, and he realizes how great this team is. And for the Nets, it's a little bit of a hedge if Kevin Durant is hurt and remains hurt with that hamstring injury. Now, he's not going to come close to replacing Kevin Durant, but it'll serve a little bit of a purpose. It's going to be interesting to see how Steve Nash incorporates him into the rotation. Mm-hmm. But it's a very, very, very small risk for the Nets, and I like the move, and I like that Blake Griffin wants to win a championship and came here. There are a lot of teams that want him. Clippers were said to be interested. The Heat, the Lakers as well, and he came here.
I don't even see what risk there is at all. You still think there is even a small one?
I don't think there's any risk.
Yeah, not really.
Yeah, I think there's zero. So you bring in a guy that's averaging over 11 points a game on one of the worst teams in the NBA. Now he comes to the Nets, bench player, maybe gets a chance to get more minutes if KD's not ready. I would not be surprised if he's rejuvenated and plays much better. And if for some reason not, well, no harm, no foul. You let him go. You lost a couple of – I don't even know how much money you would end up losing if he's gone right away. And it's worth it. I mean, I think the name is bigger than the effect they'll probably have on the team.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean it's not going to be a positive effect.
I agree. I think it's a good move.
And when you're trying to find little advantages to maybe get you over the hump against the Lakers if they get AD back, this little piece, and like I said, I feel strongly that we'll probably get a better Blake Griffin than we've seen in Detroit the last couple of years. So if this guy shows up and gives you 12, 13 points, 6, 7 boards a game, that's a big piece.
I just think it's amazing that we've lived through just the utter transformation of an afterthought franchise to one where somebody who's released and still has some basketball left in the system chooses to come here rather than the Lakers, rather than the Heat. That's how much they have changed the culture of what this team and this organization is about. And I totally credit Sean Marks. It's all him. It's all him because the ownership has changed since he took over. It's him. He has changed the way this franchise is looked at by NBA players. That's why Durant and that's why Kyrie came here. That's why Harden wanted to be traded here. And now everybody comes here because they want to win a ring. I can't recall, Don, the last time a franchise was changed the way it's looked at by the players in the league. To this extent, where this is now the destination.
It's a great question, especially without, like, drafting anybody.
Right.
Like, where was Golden State before Curry?
Right.
And then Curry's there, and then they add a few players, and then they're able to build into where, like, KD goes there. But they were still competing for a championship. But they drafted. They built that. You know, I'm not taking anything away from the Nets. They did build a lot of the foundation here. But Kyrie and KD and then the acquisition of Harden has made them, you know, now the franchise to play for. I'm not sure if it's I want to play for the Nets. It's I want to win a championship, and they've got the best chance to do it. Because right now the Lakers, it's up in the air. You've got LeBron, who's in his mid-30s, and Davis isn't playing right now. And I'd still give the Nets probably a better chance to win. They've got the best chance to win a championship. That becomes the destination. So who in professional sports have been able to land two must-have free agents and then trade for one of the best players in the league in a couple of months span? I don't know if it's ever happened.
It's amazing.
Franchises have turned it around, you know, their image. You know, Bill Parcells changed the Patriots around. You know, that's a coaching hire. Golden State with great drafts. You know, the Edmonton Oilers buying Wayne Gretzky. I mean, there's.
I mean, the Bucks did it with one move.
Yeah, but they're not to this level.
Yeah, but the Bucks. I mean, who did the Bucks get? Because there were great players there. They got Gronk,
Fournette, and Antonio Brown.
Okay, but I think those are all. That was more personal relationships with Brady rather than they changed the culture there.
No, it's not a culture change, but when you think about it, the Bucks, you know, with the exception of the Gruden Super Bowl,
right?
You're talking about they're generally seen as a losing franchise. And they went from this team that was just kind of middling and Winston was a turnover machine to in 1 year got the player, won the Super Bowl. It's pretty crazy.
It is. And then we find out later, I mean, when Adam Schefter was on with us last week, nobody really wanted Brady. There weren't that many teams clamoring for him. That was not his first choice. But they actually wanted him. There were not a lot of teams that wanted him.
But Winston did throw 30 touchdown passes.
Right.
He just threw 30 interceptions.
30 interceptions
so you knew improving the quarterback was going to put them in the conversation for the playoffs. I don't think anybody thought they were going to win a Super Bowl outside of Gary Myers. Now, is it sustainable? Like, I don't know if I'd pick the Buccaneers to win next year. But this Nets team, if they stay together, we're talking about three championships, possibly, or three kicks at the can. And the Nets have never won where the Buccaneers did win. I mean, the Nets were, I mean, we know about them because we're here in New York, but the New Jersey / Brooklyn Nets, how much gravitas did they have around the country?
They went to two straight finals and they never gained traction. Never gained traction with two Eastern Conference championships with Jason Kidd. And
but
then
those
Jason Kidd played his way out of town.
Those were good teams in a weak conference. I'm not taking anything away from those teams. I was at all of their home games during those finals. And they were patsies in the finals. I know they took the Spurs to six, but this is a legitimate championship caliber team. It's almost to the level now where we were talking about you got to at least get to the conference final. Boy, it's starting to feel like they got to win this thing now.
If they I think it's a big disappointment. I mean, it would be an accomplishment to go to the finals, but if they don't win the finals with everything they've done, how far over the cap they are, I mean, the amount of tax that Joe Tsai is paying, he expects to win a championship. He does.
I mean, you know, obviously KD is kind of an X factor in this thing. You know, so we'll see what his status is. But look how good they've been really without him. I think they can get out of the East without him. I think they got a shot.
Yeah.
Now, with KD, I think they're getting out of the East. And that's no disrespect to Philadelphia, who's hung in there, and they've actually been the better team in the regular season. But still, you know, Harden hasn't been here the whole time. We haven't seen the big three together. How many games, Peter? Eight?
Yeah,
how many games have the three played together?
One of them is a half a game. The one where they took Durant off the court.
So I was leading the charge. It's like, hey, it's their first year together. Let's be cool. They can lose to the Bucks. They can lose to the Sixers. Just at least get to the conference final. Now I'm not sure.
Here's Jay Williams. He was on with DiPietro Canty and the other guy. Jay just said, no one in the East can beat the Nets right now.
Look, Joel Embiid is playing at a different level. Ben Simmons is my defensive player of the year as of right now. But I do think the Philadelphia 76ers will be there at the end of the day. I wonder if they have enough scoring punch. You're talking about three of the most prolific scorers in the game right now, all on the same team. And I don't see anybody beating them four out of seven games in the seven-game series. I don't.
That's what I've been saying. That's the way you have to look at it. What team, constructed presently, do you envision beating this team four out of seven times? This team could lose games, but four out of seven times, the only team that I think that can do it is the Lakers with a healthy Anthony Davis. And I don't think they can do it.
Yeah,
I don't think anybody in the East can do it. I just don't. I don't think the Sixers could do it because as great a defender as Ben Simmons is, right? Well, he's got to stop one of them. Then there are two others. So They don't really play in the paint, so you're taking away a lot of the effectiveness of Joel Embiid. Now, somebody's got to guard him. That's going to be problematic, but I can't see the depth of the Sixers matching what the Nets have on the court. I just can't.
Well, it's that old Steve Young adage, what he used to say about the Rams. You know, the only team that could beat the Rams are the Rams. I mean, is it that point with the Nets that the only team that could beat the Nets are the Nets themselves if KD gets hurt, if there's any kind of infighting? Because right now, it just –
I just think
we
don't
engage. When they're healthy, they all want to play. They're sharing the ball. They're saying the right things. So that doesn't seem to be any kind of an issue.
I don't think we know, though, whether it's only the Nets can beat themselves until we see what the Lakers are at the end of the year.
Right, right. Anthony Davis, if he's Anthony Davis, that gets them to the final. But so the Nets have two, the Lakers would have two great players, and the Nets would have three and now a half.
And are we
and
so
a lot
sure
of
the Lakers
really,
are getting
really
out of the,
good role players.
Are we as sure that the Lakers are getting out of the West as the Nets are getting out of the East?
Yeah, because I'm sure now the Jazz have a chip on their shoulder about LeBron. That's a pretty good team. Very well coached.
If Davis is playing, they're getting out. If Davis is not there, the West is open.
But even that said, do you give them as good a chance as the Nets to get to the finals?
It's a good question. Clippers are very good. They're well coached.
With
Jazz
Davis,
are very good. They're well coached.
With Davis, I'm willing to say the Lakers are basically the same as the Nets.
So we could have a Cavs Warriors situation going, maybe.
Yeah, that'd well, you great. Know what the final is.
Except that LeBron keeps getting older. At some point, Mother Nature's going to knock on the
door.
Well,
at least for this year and maybe next.
Right. Let's take a brief timeout. 1-800-919-3776. Get you involved. Take some phone calls. We have a big ENN coming up at 6 o'clock.
Sure do.
And at 6:45, we're going to have the big fella on, Chris Carlin. And if you've been listening to the show and all the commercials, I've got a bone to pick with him.
Really?
He pronounced a word that I've never heard it pronounced like that. And I, as much as I love the guy, I got to take him to task.
Oh, no.
I don't think it's going to be pretty.
You know the Cheap Trick song, Peter, Dream Police?
Yeah, Michael's The Word Police.
The Word Police. We can parody that song into The Word Police.
I actually don't know the song you're referring to. I just figured it out.
But obviously you'll agree with Don if Don is mocking me, because that's what the show has become now.
Not true. Come on.
Because now why don't you just rename the show Two Men and a Baby, and I'm
the baby.
Do you
remember, Don, don't you remember last on Friday when you went after Michael about something, and I just outright said, hey, Don, I love you. I don't agree with you. I'm with Michael.
Yeah.
It happened Friday.
He doesn't remember those things at all.
Yeah, no. I mean, I think you guys have very, very astutely put together a plan where you have to agree with me every once in a while to make it look fair, but for the most part, you're piling on.
Maybe,
and, you know, I'm fine
again,
with
I'll
it.
I'll revert back
I'm
to the
open
of the show. It's not always about you, man.
In this case,
it is.
People
can actually formulate ideas and opinions, and it has nothing to do with you.
Well, isn't it odd?
Even if it's disagreeing with you.
Three adult males that you could always disagree with me. Oh, I like 90% of the time I'm wrong in your mind.
I thought about this, and please do not take this as a shot, because I love you. I do, in my soul. You're like a part of the family. The kids know your name.
Michael K.
All right? If we did not do this show together, there would be zero relationship. We have almost nothing in common. And that's why the show works. I was thinking about that the other day. Sports perspective, Met fan, Yankee fan, basketball guy, hockey guy. We don't have the same tastes in music or movies. We don't think of things the same way usually. And that's no dig. Not everybody can get along. I think we'd get along. I just don't think we would have a lot in common and have any kind of relationship. But on this show, that's magic, baby.
So you don't think that 20 years together, if this show ended, that I would be friends? That the 20 years has
no. That's
maybe
not
like
what I
20
said.
Years ago, we wouldn't be friends.
That's what I'm saying.
But still, so
the,
what you're saying
the commonality
is
commonality of this show and our relationship working together. We've built up some ties that makes you somebody that's very close in my life and that I care and love. That our relationship would now maintain. But two people, like, we talked to each other a little bit before we did the show together. I'd see you at Yankee Stadium. It'd be a high bye. And if we were ever forced to, like, hang out, we'd be like, we don't really care for each other. We don't have anything in common. But on this show, it works. And it's built into a really close relationship. But we share almost no thoughts of the same at all.
Yeah.
We grew up in different backgrounds, different states, different sensibilities. I was middle income. You were poor.
Yeah, you were upper middle class.
I don't know about to go that far.
His father owned a business.
I would not say that at all. My father had like four jobs to make the upper part of that conversation.
Well,
he was riding a Zamboni at Fritz Dietzel's. He landscaped. He worked at PSE&G.
I'm going to say the following. If your father was a Zamboni driver, within 20 years of you being born, you did not grow up rich. It's a harsh generalization, but if we survey the children of Zamboni drivers, I'm confident.
Just saying, when it's one of four jobs you have.
Do you know that the Zamboni driver at the Garden happens to be a multimillionaire? Did you know
that? Is that true?
That's right. He does it as a hobby. He likes cleaning ice.
I did not ever know that.
It's a science.
Yeah. It's a science. It's for somebody who's like OCD, you love it. Up and back and okay, all the lines. They love that. Doesn't mean that it's not a financial aspect for them.
I find it soothing, by the way. Between
have
periods,
you ever driven
watch the Zamboni work. Oh,
have you ever driven one?
No. Yeah. I would skate alongside my dad, but I never was actually on a Zamboni.
Boy, is that a beautiful Hallmark movie?
Are you? I used to skate beside my dad's Zamboni.
Yeah.
Well, I just think Dad the Zamboni is a Lifetime movie. Done. Starring
Tony
Danza.
You know that it's an ice-making machine, not a Zamboni. Zamboni's like Jell-O. That's the name of the company, but because it's the only one anybody thinks of, they call it a Zamboni, but it's the name of the company. It's actually an ice-making machine.
I did not know that. And
ice resurfacing machine is actually.
By the way, what a great marketing job by the people at Zamboni. Because, I mean,
like
we
Kleenex.
Don't. Yeah. They,
right,
Zamboni
like
is the
you never,
Kleenex.
You never say gelatin, right? You say, I want Jell-O.
Right. I did not know Zamboni was the Kleenex of ice-making machines.
Well, why
that's
do you think
how you know they
call
killed
it a Zamboni then?
Wow.
Well, we've learned a lot. We've learned a lot in this segment. Don and I have nothing in common. That's why he always disagrees with me. He's brought up differently than I do. He has different values. Okay, I get it. Now we know moving forward exactly what we're dealing with.
But no, you're missing the whole point, but that's part of the
point. What's the point? Tell me what I'm missing, genius.
That you guys are, in spite of your differences, you've now become like family and you're very close.
But if you had your way,
it's not surprising you don't agree on everything. That's part of why it works.
The reason that we become close is we've both made each other an incredible amount of money. That's the reason.
An incredible amount. Honestly.
When you think about it, it's incredible.
It is. Where we came from, it's an incredible amount of money.
I think it would blow my father's mind if he knew.
If he saw your paycheck for 1 week, it would blow his mind.
Because he didn't think he was really wondering why I was trying to do this for a living. He's like, "There's not going to be any money in this, but go have fun, try to
I
make
do
it
well."
See,
Andrew's yelling at me to break, so
oh,
I have to
please.
Listen to what he says. Kay, LaGreca, Rosenberg, and you on Yes and 98.7 ESPN.
Thanks for listening to the Michael K. Show podcast.
Hey, buddy, hey.
Catch the show on demand wherever you want. Just subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts.
I can't hear this song without thinking Stephen A. Smith's
can't
old
do it.
Radio show is about
Not
to
possible.
Start. Am I right, Don?
It's his theme
so
song.
So we agree on this.
Yes.
And sometimes it would play for like a minute and a half before he would come on because he's got to run down the hall from First Take. And so this song is like emblazoned in my head.
Yeah, absolutely. I miss Steven.
Well, he's still around.
Yeah, but I don't get a chance to see him. I don't get a chance to talk to him. And I don't get a chance to listen to him on the radio.
You want his number? I'll give you his number if you want.
I got his number.
Then call him.
He doesn't want to hear from me.
So you miss talking to a guy who doesn't want to hear from you. At least I don't want to hear from you.
That'd be a very awkward and uncomfortable conversation for him if I called him up and said, "Steven, I just missed your voice."
No, but if you texted him, though, and you said, "Hey, Steven, Don Juan here, just wanted to say what's up."
He would answer.
Oh, yeah, in a heartbeat.
You think he would?
Oh, yeah.
Michael, send him the number.
He has the number.
I have it.
I bet if you text him and say, you have to give him time, because if you haven't texted him in years, it's possible like it would go to the, numbers he doesn't recognize.
Well, that's why you say in the text, just say dash Don LaGreca.
You got to say dash Don LaGreca. But once he says, "Yo, it's Steve, it's Steven, it's Don Juan, just checking in."
I thought I had it. I don't.
I'll send it
right over.
Maybe we could do it during the show. Now, I look to you for things like this, Peter, because you're kind of my hip guy that I know.
Oh, yeah, so hip.
other than the guy who actually takes care of my hip.
But
how is it that an interview with two people that are part of the, or used to be part of the British royal family, is able to garner 17.1 million viewers on CBS? How is that possible? And great sporting events are getting like 3-4 million. I have never, ever in my life understood the fascination with the royal family of England. I don't get it. They're rich people that were born into richness. They don't do anything. Everything they do is ceremonial. So now you're going to take two people that kind of like split off from them. They're not living in California. Why do people care what these two people have to say?
Well, listen, I don't know if I'm the best person to ask about this because I have never cared. I've never understood the fascination at all. The only thing I will say is I am so impressed by Oprah to be that successful and still have that much drive for an interview. Like, she really pursued this. She was, like, really desperate to get this interview. And then she gets it and knows that it's going to get seven. That's why she was desperate for it. She knows I was going to get 17 million. And she nailed it. Who's motivated?
She sold it to CBS for, like, $7 million.
Who is still motivated, though? What's Oprah, 65?
I don't know.
She's in her 60s. She's a billionaire. And she was like, I need to get this interview. It's
so
not like anyone else.
Driving any Zamboni is what you're saying.
I don't think Oprah or anyone in her immediate family will be driving a Zamboni anytime soon. But no, I don't understand. The funny thing is, at first I was like, oh man, Oprah, bad timing. Up against the All-Star game? Yeah, not so much.
Yeah, she destroyed kind of the All-Star game.
God, they should have moved the All-Star game.
And it's I'm funny a big fan of Oprah.
Don always says, I love this kind of like pop culture. I didn't think for a second of watching it.
No.
I couldn't care less about these people. Who are they? What impact do they have on our lives? The things going on in the world right now. Maybe we all need some kind of like separation from reality. That could be it.
Well,
but these are insignificant people that will have no impact on our lives.
There's a couple of things at play here. By the way, in January 29th, she turned 67.
Wow.
So she looks fabulous. I think a lot of this has to go back to Princess Di. I think we've always had an infatuation in this country, not me, but the country in general, with the royal family. But the significance of that wedding to Prince Charles, what she meant to so many people for so long, her death, I think has really attached us even more. And I think we looked at Meghan as possibly being that this generation's Diana. And I think that's why so many people are attracted to the story. So
it does nothing
for me, but clearly 17 million people on a March Sunday watching that tells me that we're in the minority.
So
there are people very much interested.
I'm going to completely contradict myself. As I just said, I don't care about it, and I don't understand it. However, you guys know, based on my love of wrestling, I'm a fan of a good storyline, especially one that really plays out over time. The storyline is great for people because Harry lost his mom. There's obviously a ton of speculation and controversy about what actually happened to her. She was always seen as sort of different than the royal family and didn't fit. And she was this great humanitarian, so loved by people of all backgrounds. And now this is the son of her with his biracial wife who splits off. It does, and then in their interview, reveals things that while many people may have suspected it, had never confirmed it about the royal family. So for a lot of people who always loved Diana and were skeptics of the royal family, this was also sort of a middle finger back from Diana.
If Diana never happened, if Diana didn't marry Prince Charles, I don't think we'd be as infatuated.
It would have been someone else, though.
That wedding was huge. I was a kid at the time, but that was huge. That really brought a lot of attention. Because really, there's nothing interesting about them anymore. I think it's fascinating how long that they've ruled and all that. I'm not saying that it's completely uninteresting, but come on, Diana's one of the most iconic people that ever walked on this planet when you think about it.
How long that they've ruled. They have no power. They're figureheads. Well, I was there in London. I love London, by the way. Love it.
You're a big London guy.
And I turned to Jordan. I said, you know what? The country should take all this property away from them. It's a waste of money.
They probably get a lot of money. Influence. They clearly have influence.
What influence? They don't have any power in government.
They don't have any power, but you know, like, there's a lot of people that don't have power in this country, but they have influence.
I would say, I think you'd be going out on a limb here to say that the royal family does not have power or influence.
A 96-year-old woman has power and influence over the royal, over Boris Johnson.
I think that they have power and influence over everything. I think it goes deeper than that.
I don't know.
They didn't get that job by accident. This has been a long time.
Totally by accident.
Well, yes, but I mean, it's been in that family for a very long time.
Right, by accident.
But yeah, but my point is
they were born into it.
But my point is Boris Johnson comes and goes. They're always in that palace.
But Boris Johnson could say, I'm going to go bomb a country. Queen Elizabeth can't.
Right. And she would like, go ahead and bomb your country, little man. Do whatever you want to do. We're still going to be rich and running things on level.
But here's the influence. If she doesn't back Johnson, Johnson can lose the country.
Right. Mm. I mean, I'm not saying, Michael, you are right that it's stupid. I'm just saying British imperialism is a pretty important thing in the history of the world. And it runs directly with the royal family.
When they had power. They don't have power.
But they're still the family that did it. But they're still the family.
I guess the closest thing we have to a royal family in this country is the Kennedys, right? But they don't have any power unless they're in elected office.
But hold up, the Kennedys, no. You know what? This is one of the worst moments you've ever had in the history of the show.
This is what I mean, people. If I say it, it's wrong.
The Kennedys are simply a family that rose to power through whatever shady means they initially did, then got into office and had a lot of people that were in office. But this has been the family that has ruled not only that country, but other countries, created this country, went around the world, enslaved people, took, stole, ravaged, raped. They did it all. It all started there. Right. So, yeah, they don't run the government.
No, but here's the sports comparable, because apparently I'm blowing people's minds with this conversation, is the royal family is to England what LeBron James is to the NBA. LeBron James doesn't have any power. He's not the commissioner. But you got to make sure he's on board most times. Otherwise, I think the commissioner would have a lot of trouble getting things done, because LeBron has way more influence than Silver does with the fan base, with other players. He technically has no power, but tons of influence.
Well, he didn't want the All-Star game that got played.
Well, I'm not saying that everything that he wants happens, but you don't think that LeBron James has power in the NBA?
Listen, people are saying watch The Crown, which I did. So Margaret Thatcher used to go talk with Queen Elizabeth. And she would give her, like, you know, advice on things. But there's no power there. If Margaret Thatcher says, take a walk, sister, nothing's going to happen.
Yeah, you know what the power is, Michael? When someone who's not even directly in the family anymore does an interview, 18 million people in this country stop and watch.
Right.
And that's the power.
I don't get it. I don't get it. I understand they've gripped people's imagination for nothing. For nothing.
But it's not for nothing. It's only for nothing now.
The Michael K. Show. What does that mean?
I'm not talking about now.
I'm not talking about.
But hold on. So let me try to think of a comparison. So if Walt Disney creates the Disney Company, runs it, his entire family runs it, and then afterwards, this is a bad example. You can't even find a fair way to compare it.
You know why? Because it's incomprehensible that they have any kind of hold on people's imagination.
You're right. Well, I don't disagree with that part. I'm not disagreeing with you. It is stupid. But for you to actually say they're irrelevant, okay, but they still are. It's still the Queen of England. They still have the palace. They're still incredibly famous. The guards are still sitting out there.
Right.
Like, it's all still the same. They just don't wield political power officially.
So let me get this straight. Maybe this is a better parallel. So the Windsors, or whatever their last names are, whatever.
Yes, the Windsors.
They are to this country what the Kardashians are.
That's right.
No power, but just everybody can't look away.
If up until 10 years ago, the Kardashians had also made every decision for our country.
Because there was a time where they had power.
It was always. It's a blip of time that they haven't had power.
And
in the grand scheme of things,
and if Joe Biden had to go and kiss the ring, like Joe Biden becomes president and now has to go to the Kardashian's house and kiss the ring.
Right.
Because that's what the prime minister has to do.
Only because of tradition, Don.
But
if he decides not to do it, he doesn't do it.
And he'll lose the country, so that's why he does it. So the influence is very powerful. Yeah, right. They have zero power, tons of influence.
See,
if one of Boris Johnson's daughters get married, seven people show up.
If one of those guys get married,
forget about it. The entire world stops.
Because we're fascinated with fame and money.
Right, and
world.
That creates influence.
But if I want to become Prime Minister of England and I would disband the royal family, you're out. You're absolutely out. Let's see what would happen to me. You're all out.
I love
nothing. No king and queen, nothing. No princes, you're out. We're not going to fund this. We're not going to spend money on security for you. You're out. Every one of you is out.
It's a great idea, and if you do it, Don and I will be the first one supporting it.
Yes, I would support it, but if you ran on that ticket, you wouldn't get elected.
Well, I changed my mind after I got in. The Michael K. Show on 98.7 ESPN is brought to you by God. I kissed the ring up to that point. The real value in car insurance isn't how much you save. It's also the kind of service you get. Good thing Geico's been perfecting both for over 75 years. Kayla Greca, Rosenberg and you on Yes and 98.7 ESPN.
Thanks for listening to the Michael K. Show podcast. Hear more of Michael, Don, and Peter live weekday afternoon starting at 2:55 on 98.7 ESPN in New York, the ESPN app, the TuneIn app, or on your smart speaker.
Hey, Alexa, play 98.7 ESPN.